Okay, good evening everyone. Broadcasting live from on October 28th, 2015. Start with a Dhammapada verse. As you can see, I've got a little bit of a setup going on here. And you'll see why that is when we get, when you see the actual YouTube video. Because... we'll see. It's an experiment. Hello and welcome back to our study of the Dhammapada. Today we continue on with verse number 97, which reads as follows. Asaddho akatanyucha santi cedho jayonaro hatavakaso vantaso save uttama poliso. Which on the face means one who is faithless, asaddho, akatanyu, one who is ungrateful, sandhi chedo, a robber, someone who breaks into other people's houses, jayonaro, whatever man or person, hatavakaso, has destroyed opportunity, has cut off, has opportunity cut off. Vantaso is hopeless. Satve uttama poriso, such a person is the height of humanity. So, a rather odd verse coming from the Buddha. But you have to understand the context, and then we'll explain that on face value it means one thing, but when you understand the context, and when you think about when a person looks at the Pali words, it means something quite different. So the story is again about Sariputta, and it's in regards to 30 monks who had been dwelling in the forest, intently practicing meditation, and the Buddha saw that there was, somehow he saw that they needed something. They needed perhaps to move away from faith, one might think, based on the story. The Buddha anyway saw that they needed some push, and if they were given a push in the right direction, it might put them back on the right path and lead them to become enlightened. He saw potential in them. And so he used Sariputta as his sort of his catalyst by asking Sariputta a question when they were in his presence. So these monks came to the Buddha, pay respect. The Buddha decided how he was going to teach them. He turned to Sariputta and he says, Sariputta, do you have faith? Saddahasi, do you believe that the faculty of faith, when cultivated, when made much of, leads to the deathless and ends in the deathless? And asked about all five of the faculties. It's not just the faith faculty, but there are five faculties. There's saddha, which is faith or confidence, vidya, which is effort, sati, which is mindfulness, samadhi, concentration or focus, and panya, which is wisdom. So he asked about these five faculties, but he asked, do you believe? And Sariputta gave a sort of a nuanced reply. He didn't just say yes or no. He said, it's not out of faith. He said, Nakwahang bante eta bhagavato sadhaya gachami. I don't get to that out of faith in the Blessed One. As we're in regards to the faith faculty being, when cultivated, leading to Nibbana, and same with the effort faculty and the mindfulness faculty and the concentration faculty and the wisdom faculty. He says, but so basically he says, I don't go to faith in that regard, faith in the Blessed One in that regard. That's a Pali way of saying, I don't have faith in the Blessed One in that regard. Or it can be interpreted to mean that. And he said, but someone who has not seen the truth, who has not come to realize the truth for themselves, such a person would have faith in the Blessed One thus. They would have faith in someone else thus, or would get to this by faith in someone else. So I don't go to faith in the Blessed One. I don't get to that through faith in the Blessed One. And if we, as Buddhists, we tend to understand what he meant, it's not out of faith, because he says, for someone who has not seen, not understood for themselves, they need to have faith. So it's actually pretty clear, but the Pali somehow makes it ambiguous. And these 30 monks, again with the criticism, start talking amongst themselves and saying, even Sariputta, it's amazing, he hasn't given up his wrong views, he's still faithless. He has no faith in the Buddha, he still, after all this time, doesn't have this faith in the Buddha. It's a valid criticism. I mean, it would be if they hadn't misunderstood what he was saying. If he had actually meant that he just had no faith in the Buddha whatsoever. But of course, the Buddha hears about what they're saying and says, monks, what are you talking about? And when they tell him, he explains to them. He says, but, Sariputta, when I asked him, he answered me quite clearly. And what he meant was that it's not faith, it's not out of faith, it's through understanding. And because he has seen the truth through the practice of Samatha meditation, Vipassana meditation, has realized the path in fruition. Sadhaya, paresang sadhaya nagacchati. Doesn't require faith. It doesn't get there through faith in another. He gets there through his own knowledge. And then he said this verse. And so what's interesting about this verse is it confuses them even more, right? He says, someone who is faithless is the best, is the height. And the meaning is they don't have faith. They don't require faith to know the truth. Such a person who has seen the truth for themselves and no longer has to believe, right? So you tell them the truth and they can verify or deny it. They can verify the truth without requiring belief. You can say, it's like this. They don't have to believe you. They know it is the truth. It's better, obviously. Akatanyu, and then he goes on to confuse them more or play with them more. He says, akatanyu. Akatanyu literally means it literally means one of two things. But akata, a means not. Kata means done. And anyu, anyau means, anyu means one who knows. So it usually means one who knows not what was done, in the sense of knowing not what someone else has done for you. So if I do you a favor and you don't keep that in mind, you aren't conscious of the fact that something's been done for you, it's a way of saying you're ungrateful. Akatanyu is a common word that means, it's a compound that means someone who is ungrateful for the things other people have done for them. It can also, and the Buddha's using it here in a different way, it means one who knows that which is not done. Akata anyu. Akata means what is not done, or what is not made, the unmade. And the unmade here is nibbana. So it's a play on words that is, of course, lost in the English. But akata nyu means one who knows nibbana. Sandhi cheda literally means one who has cut the chain. Sandhi means the connection or the chain. And it is a word that, it is a compound that was used to mean one who breaks into people's houses, cutting through the locks, the lock on the door. But here is someone who has picked the lock on samsara and unlocked, or broken the chain, it's more correct, broken the chain of rebirth. So being born old, sick, and dying is a chain. And so one who has broken that is one who is free from samsara. Hatavakaso, one who has destroyed opportunity or has had opportunity cut off, means one who has no opportunities for them. That's what it normally would mean. But here it's a specific meaning. Again, it's a play on words, but it means for one for whom there is no opportunity for further becoming. So opportunity is, in a sense, another word for becoming this or becoming that. You know, they don't have ambitions or plans because they don't think about the future. And finally, wanta so means hopeless. And hopeless is, of course, a very good thing. It's an excellent thing to be hopeless. It means you have no hope. You don't hope for anything because you have no expectations. No expectations, no desires. You aren't living in the future again. You're living only in the present, perfectly flexible and content no matter what happens, no matter what comes or doesn't come. So this is the meaning the Buddha said, Satve Uttama Puriso. Such a one is indeed the height of humanity. So what does this mean for our practice? Well, first, before we actually get into the context, in the story the Buddha talks about the five faculties, which in and of themselves are a really good teaching. This is a teaching that has been taken from the Samyutta Nikaya, and it's an important teaching. We have the concept of these five faculties and talk about them in the meditation practice. You have to balance confidence with wisdom and cultivate them both, but in tandem. So if you have too much confidence, not enough wisdom, that's a bad thing. If you have a lot of wisdom, but you don't have any confidence in it, so you know a lot of things, not really wisdom. But without the confidence, you're always doubting the things that you learn and the things that you come to understand. Did I really see that? Is this really useful? Effort and concentration also have to be balanced. So if you have a lot of effort, you'll become distracted without enough focus if the effort isn't focused enough. If you have a lot of focus but not the effort, you'll fall into a stupor and you'll become tired and fall asleep. So these two have to be balanced as well, and they both have to be cultivated. Now sati is the ability to see things as they are, basically, to recognize reality. Sati means to recognize or to remember yourself. I mean, to remind yourself. The ability to see things and to recognize things as they are without any kind of extrapolation. Not thinking, seeing things as good or bad or so on. So mindfulness is actually what balances the other faculties, because you don't get off in one way or another. You don't get caught up in too much energy, too much concentration. You become natural. You just let things sort themselves out without forcing anything. So absolutely these five, when they work together and when you use mindfulness to balance the other four, are definitely the path to the deathless. And by the deathless is meant this, you know, this freedom from the rounds of rebirth, freedom from being born again. The only way to not die is to not be born. And so if we're born again and again and again, we'll always have to die again and again and again. So deathless just means that state of freedom from that. That's the first lesson. Second lesson, of course, again, this lesson, criticizing others can be a dangerous thing to do if you're not clear. But on the other hand, these 30 monks were provided the perfect opportunity for the Buddha to teach the Dhamma. So there is that. When something's unclear and when something appears to be wrong, it is important not to keep quiet and think, oh, well, I don't want to stir up the boat. It is important to bring it up and ask why. Why is it like that? You know, and why does it seem like this monk is faithless? And then when we get into the actual verse, we have some important things to say, I think. Asaddho is really an important point. It's a difference between Buddhism and other religions. It doesn't mean that you shouldn't believe anything. It just means that believing at something is inferior to knowing it for yourself, and Buddhism will always hold it to be so. Whereas other religions believe that faith is ultimate. They believe there are certain things that you can't know, that it is somehow important to have faith in. And so they set up this system whereby you cultivate faith, and you have to work hard to cultivate it, because faith is not something that is stable, not like wisdom, or not like mindfulness, not like awareness. Faith is something, well, not like wisdom actually, because wisdom is stable when you come to see things clearly. You don't have to work to maintain it. No. It's something that is stronger. Whereas with faith, you have to push and push, and you have to always be repressing your doubts. Or you could say faith that comes with wisdom, when they're both balanced. The faith that comes with wisdom, because in fact, you could also say that Sariputta has perfect confidence in the truth. You know, he has perfect confidence in the things that the Buddha was asking him. The answer is yes, and he has perfect confidence in that. But it's faith that's based on wisdom, based on knowledge. And so again, how you have to balance them. But the Buddha was fairly critical about the idea of people who just take things on faith, which it was a big thing in the Buddha's time as well. The Brahmins were big on faith. They believed that their rituals had some higher meaning to them without any rational explanation, or they believed in this god or that god without having seen or heard. They believed in Brahma. So they created all these beliefs, and then they just had faith in them. They didn't have any knowledge or understanding about their truth or falsehood. So in meditation, this should be our emphasis, not on believing that somehow this meditation is going to help us, but in using the meditation to learn about ourselves, so that we don't need faith, we don't need to believe anyone else. That's really what we're doing. You want, I can tell you all about the mind, how the mind works, and what reality is like. I can give you lecture after lecture. But that's always going to be inferior to you actually opening up the box and looking inside, which is what you do in meditation. You open up and you look, and you see how are things going on. The technique that we give you is just to provide you with a framework, like a tool in which to look, like when you peer into a microscope. We give you this, and you look in the microscope, and whatever is there, you'll see. So watching your stomach rising and falling as you watch it, and you use the mantra to keep yourself objective, you'll start to see things. You'll be in an objective frame of mind, like you're focusing the microscope. And once you get it well focused, you'll be able to see things as they are, and then you won't need to believe me. Akatanyu is about what this is all about. The height, the pinnacle, is to see that which is not made, or to know that which is not made. And point being that as you look in this microscope through the meditation, what you're going to see is that everything that arises ceases. And you'll come to the realization or the understanding that there's nothing in the world that is truly and intrinsically of value. There's no experience that you can have, no goal you can attain in the world, because everything is made by causes and conditions. It arises and it ceases, and it's a part of a web of causation. Now, Nibbana, or this, there is that which is outside of this cause of causation. It doesn't arise, and therefore it doesn't cease. And this is considered to be the height. When someone realizes this, it's unique. They have this experience of some unique state, or unique entity, or unique reality that is unmade, that is unformed, unborn. So that is the height. It's something that changes the way we look at reality, because in contrast, everything else becomes meaningless. And when one who has realized this or seen this, they'll never be enticed by or intoxicated by those things that arise and cease because they're clearly, categorically inferior. Santi Cheda means cutting the link. So another great thing is one doesn't have to be born old, sick, and die again. I mean, people sometimes, most humans are fairly much attached to life, and if you ask them, would you like to come back and do this all again and again, many would, I think, say, yes, please, it would give me an opportunity to learn more and to experience things I didn't experience in this life. It'd be great to come back. Forgetting as we do, this is we have this confirmation bias or positive bias, so we're very quick to forget about all the problems in life. And moreover, when you think it through, what you're talking about is an infinite recursion, right? You're talking about this infinite cycle. And so it's that is fairly problematic, because it really becomes meaningless after a while, and it ends up being not nearly as much trouble as it's worth. Being a human being is a lot of trouble. And clearly we've, in all the time we've spent in the rounds of rebirth, we keep coming back to things like this. We go up and down, and so sometimes it's great and sometimes it's horrible. Sometimes it's mind-numbingly painful and cruel and unpleasant. Sometimes it's pleasant, incredibly stupefyingly pleasant. But in the end, it's just a round of rebirth again and again. And in the end, it's completely unsatisfying. It's not something that you intellectually or let go out of faith. You don't have to believe me. The point is that when you look closely, you naturally incline away from it. So through the meditation, you become less inclined to create, less inclined to chase after this pleasure, because it's a lot of work. And then you have it, and then it disappears, and you're left with nothing except your attachment to it, which then leads to you to lots of suffering. So cutting the stream, cutting the chain, this is the part of the goal. And it's just, this again, with the theme, it just goes back to knowledge, not belief. It's not something to be afraid of. You can't just fall into it. Most people, I think, are afraid of the idea of Nibbana, or some kind of unknowable, mysterious state of so-called freedom. But when you've experienced it, there's no question in the mind which is preferable. Mind lets go immediately of those things that are completely unbeneficial and unsatisfying. Hatavakaso means they've given up the opportunity for becoming, and this has to do with giving up defilements. It means giving up all kinds of unwholesomeness, but also any kind of wholesomeness. So giving up the desire to even do good in the world, to bring the world to good, to save the world, to change the world. All of these things one eventually gives up, and that's considered preferable, because in the end you can't change the world, you can't fix the world. In the end, everything that you've done in the world will cease and fade away. Over time, in the face of eternity, it's really nothing. You want to save the planet, save the environment. To some extent, that's a good deed. It's kind of you to think about other people and to think about society and want everyone to be happy, so it's good, and for most of us it's a great thing. But for someone who becomes enlightened, they give up any idea of fixing things, because in the end it's inherently broken. Of course, along the way they do a lot of good, and by becoming enlightened they also do a lot of good and end up making the world a better place for everyone, because they give up their own greed, their own attachments, their own conflicts and anger, and their own arrogance and conceit and so on. So there's really nothing to criticize about it, but they certainly give up everything. They have no opportunity for this future becoming, no more ambition. And once does so, they are hopeless. So our practice is to give up our hopes, because if you hope, it means you still have a goal. And when someone becomes free from suffering, when they attain the ultimate goal, then there's no other reason for them to hope or wish. They see that hopes and wishes are actually a cause of suffering, because even if you get what you want, get what you wish for, you'll at the same time be giving rise to attachment to it. And then you build up and build up the attachment until eventually that goal is attained and lost over time, At which point all you're left with is the attachment, which again leads to suffering. So this is an explanation of that verse, and sort of a outline of the sorts of qualities of an enlightened being. For our own practice, we emulate some of these, and we cultivate some of these, and we keep some of them in mind philosophically to help us know how to direct our minds in the meditation practice. So another useful, if a bit, I would say, tongue-in-cheek. I mean, I don't really want to implicate the Buddha in any way, but it's definitely a clever verse. Meant perhaps, it seems, to shock and to throw off guard the listener. So that's the verse for tonight. Thank you all for tuning in. Wishing you all the best. Be well. Okay. Just give me a second here while I turn off some of these lights. So I had to backlight. The idea is to make the back lit up so that it overexposes. And anyway. Good evening, everyone. Good evening, Robin.
Good evening, Bhante.
Today we have a couple of people here meditating overnight, come for the weekend, so that's always nice, sleeping in the basement. Up on our meditation page, do we have questions?
We do.
Okay, I think we have to kind of be a little bit strict about questions, that they should be fairly clearly related to one's practice in meditation. I'll take some theoretical Buddhist questions, but only if they're theoretical and not speculative, because I think some people are kind of getting a little bit reasonably tired of, I don't know, a little bit turned off by speculative questions, and I kind of agree, you know? It's not what we're here for. Go to Stack Exchange. Buddhism.stackexchange.com. They'll take all your speculative and debate, controversial questions. You won't find me there anymore, though. I shouldn't say that. Stack Exchange is a good place. I'm being serious. Really, go there, ask your questions, you get good answers. Not here. So any questions like, what do you think about X, will not be tolerated. I'm sorry. Okay, what do we got?
We have.
Now I have to ask again, do we have any questions?
We do. Going back to last night,
all right.
This is the last night question. May we call you teacher if we have not done formal meditation courses with you?
Yeah, we don't have anything like that in Buddhism. You can call me teacher if you think I teach you something. You know, don't cling so much to the idea. You know, some people even cling to the idea, oh yeah, well, this person is my teacher. He's taken me as a student. I hear a lot of this in Buddhism, and it's really just ego. People will say, I was called to teach, or I was called as a student, or I was initiated as a student. That's just it's just ego. It's self. I'm not a teacher. I'm not the teacher. Certainly not. I mean, no one is. You know, take the word teacher at face value, someone who teaches. So if someone teaches you something, they're your teacher. I had real trouble with this. It's funny because there is a story to tell. Not a very good one, but it's still something that's kind of not entirely clear in my mind. So I had a teacher when I first started in practicing meditation who was a lay person, and I spent about 2 years under his tutelage until at one point I just got, I was still with this teacher, but kind of in a bad place in a way, because I felt confused, and at this point, looking back, it feels like I was to some extent being manipulated, but we all were. It was kind of it feels now like it was a manipulative system, like a lot of dealing with charisma and this kind of sense of that the teacher knows something you don't and is being mysterious and enigmatic. There was a lot of this enigmatic sayings and stuff that didn't quite understand, but it was clear that the teacher understood more than you, that kind of thing. I mean, in the end, it just came down to a lot of charisma, from what I can see, and not so much on the wisdom side. That's how it felt like. That's how it still feels like. So, I went to study under Ajahn Tong at this point, and it completely changed the way I thought about teaching. Not so much about the practice, because I'll give that, the person who was teaching me in the beginning was a capable teacher, insofar as passing on the technique goes. As far as leading someone through a course, I still think there's a lot that could be improved there. Still not so keen on the way it was done, and it goes without saying, not nearly as proficient as Ajahn Tong. It was a different attitude, you see, because the way Ajahn Tong teaches is very straightforward. It's nothing to do with him, and it's nothing about anything mysterious or enigmatic. You ask him a question, he gives you a frank reply. You know, usually, and then another neat thing is usually from the Buddha's teaching. So he'll raise a verse, like you say, oh, I'm obsessed with this, you know, something happened in the past, and he'd say, oh, you know, the Buddha said, don't go back to the past. No, don't go to the future. And he'll recite, Adita nanvagame anapatikanke anagatang. So all of a sudden, I was hearing Pali for the first time. Wow, someone actually uses the Pali that I'd been studying on my own. And if you came to him and said, oh, I feel so guilty about these things I did, and I feel like I just was such a bad person in the past, and he'd say, oh, very good. That's good. A person who was negligent in the past, but but now becomes vigilant, lights up the earth, lights up themselves, lights up the world, like the moon coming out from behind a cloud. And then he'd tell the Pali, "Yo pube pamaji tua pachaso na pamajiti." We'll get to that verse eventually, in the Pamadavaga, I guess. Anyway, just hard to describe, but everyone that came to him left smiling and with a clear mind, not confused, which is what I often felt. I shouldn't be so hard. I mean, I was doing practice before this, but long story short, I decided to reject or give up my past teacher, and there were other things involved, like... Once I started learning how Ajahn taught, I started teaching that way as well. I was having other meditators at the time. My first teacher had gone around the world. He teaches around the world as a layperson in many countries throughout the year. And he had gone away, so I was taking over his duties of teaching foreigners in the monastery. And I started teaching them the way Ajahn Tong teaches, which is somewhat different from the way my teacher teaches. And then when he came back, I sent them all back to him, and it required a huge adjustment on their part because it's a totally different. And then he came up to me and told me that I have to, he said, anyway, just a really messy situation, started telling me I have to teach them the way he taught, and just so many things just didn't add up. And I got really angry. This was, you know, I was still... It was a hard time. I'd only been a monk for a couple of years, less than 2 years. I'd only been a monk for a year, I think, and less than 2 years. And it was just, I didn't know what to do, where to turn, and so I got really upset. And I told him that, I told someone, one of his students, that, and this is the point of the story, that I didn't consider him my teacher. He said, how can you reject this? How can you act like this? This person is your teacher. And I said, he's not my teacher. Ajahn Tong is my teacher. And it was just that one statement. And they then took it to Ajahn Tong and said I was ungrateful, and how after all that he's taught me, I don't even recognize anything that he's taught me, and so on and so on. And I tell this story as it relates to you, because I do kind of disagree. I mean, in Thai, when you translate what I said back into Thai, it sounds a little bit bad, because Thai doesn't have this clarification of tense. So when you say someone's not your teacher, it means they never were, or it can be ambiguous that way. But what I mean to instruct with this example is the idea that you can change teachers, and there really should be no sense. Well, there's two things, I guess. There should be no sense that someone has a hold on you, like you have to take them as your, like, they are always your teacher, or that it's some initiation thing that you are initiated into and then you're in for life or something, or you have to somehow take a formal ceremony or something to unbecome their student. But on the other hand, there is something that is very real there that has to be acknowledged. If someone has taught you something and you don't recognize it, then you are ungrateful. Absolutely. And I was called ungrateful. And to be called ungrateful by the person who you've really put a lot of your time and energy and faith into, it was really tough. I remember going up to one of the other monk teachers, and asking him, I said, how do you know if you're an evil person? Because I really wasn't sure at that point. I mean, I didn't feel evil. I didn't feel like I was in the wrong, but it's hard when your teacher, yeah. Anyway, point being, two things. Anyone who's taught you is their teacher, is your teacher, or has that claim on you, and there's a sense of gratitude that is reasonable, and I think a duty of ours, you know, to be grateful for those who have helped us. But two, anytime you want to take someone as your teacher, you consider they're your teacher. If you decide they're not your teacher, I don't see any reason to have to say, oh yes, that person is my teacher. They were my teacher, but they're not anymore. Because I don't agree with the way they teach. I don't like many of their ways, and you know, it doesn't suit me to take them as my teacher anymore. Recognizing that they have taught me things and they have done things for me. So not exactly your question, but related to this idea of having someone as a teacher, like just that it somehow means something. All it means is they've helped you. The Buddha called a teacher a good friend, a giver of meditation. The person who gives you meditation practice is your good friend. I mean, they're the best friend you could have, because they've done something that most friends can't do for you, provided they give you good meditation teachings. So, yeah. Long story short, you can call me teacher if you want, but don't take it to mean anything, really. It just means, oh yeah, that's the guy I learned meditation from. I'm really grateful to him for that. It's enough. I mean, at least somewhat grateful, I hope, unless it was useless to you, in which case, no need to feel grateful.
Bhante, the other night you were going to tell us a story about Ajahn Tong when he came out of his kuti and he didn't have his upper robe, and you started to tell the story. Then we got off on a tangent talking about robes.
did I really not finish the story?
Didn't finish the story because we got off on a tangent and talked about robes for a long time.
That's funny. And there was a point to the story as well. It was a really important story in the context, I think, right? We were talking about criticism. Oh, we were talking about, it was a good story. It's a shame, really.
Finish it now.
Yeah, so what's the story? So he's about to go off, and then I say, you know, Ajahn doesn't have his outer robe on, because to me it was somehow, I didn't realize that it wasn't necessary. I thought, you know, he always went out. In fact, I knew from the rules it wasn't, but I kind of thought it was a Thai thing that I was new. I'd just gotten back. He stops in his tracks. He's just on the way out the door. He stops, turns around, and goes and sits down on his chair again. And he turns to me, like, totally serious, like, I don't know what's going on. And he starts to explain to me, not angry, not upset, but concerned, that you only need the robe. They only wear the robe when they go to the Uposatha, or when they go to chanting, I think he said. When they have a ceremony, when there's a ceremony, they wear the outer robe. And it's like he wanted to be sure that I was clear on why he was doing it, because there was a sense that I was criticizing him, and that wasn't my intention at all. But he wanted to be clear about it. He wanted me to not have that misgiving in my mind. That's what I got from it. It was quite surprising.
It's nice that he took the time. Mm.
But it's great to see how conscientious he is. Like, he doesn't get angry, or he wouldn't get angry or upset that someone had criticized him. He wants to be clear that he wants to be to clear their doubts. You know, if you have some, that's what it seemed. He wanted to be clear that I didn't leave with some idea that he was doing the wrong thing. So he's conscientious. That was quite nice.
Mm-hmm.
Kind of unique.
Thank you for telling the rest of the story. I was wondering about that. When can we expect to see the interview with Robin video?
We really didn't do one. We didn't have any time where I asked you about the course.
No.
Hmm. Well, we could do that tomorrow.
Oh, no. That would be better when I go back to meditate.
All right.
After
we can do it here, no?
Yes, after the first of the year, I get vacation time. I'd love to come back to meditate when it's convenient for you.
Sure.
That would be much better.
In February, there's another reading week, so that would be the best time.
Oh, February would be great. Is a 2-meter-long line for walking meditation acceptable for taking part in the online course? That is the longest path I currently have at my disposal. Thank you, Bunpei.
If that's what you got, you can do walking meditation in place. I taught some kids once lifting, placing, lifting, placing, lifting their feet up and placing them down in place. It's not about walking, it's about the movements of the feet. So yeah, if you walk back and forth 6 feet, then stop, turn around the whole time, just be mindful of each movement. That's the most important.
I think we'll skip this question because it's a what do you think of question. Bhante, in the Magga Mangala Sutta, to have done meritorious actions in the past and set oneself in the right course, that is the greatest blessing, which I took to mean to set oneself up for abandoning immorality, faithlessness, and selfishness, and to cultivate morality, faith, and for generosity. Does the Buddha mean faith in the Dhamma and not faith in him? Does he mean faith in oneself? Thank you.
There's no such thing as abandoning faithlessness. You took it wrong, I think. Yeah, there's not much the Buddha said about someone doesn't have faith in me or faith in the Dhamma or faith in oneself. There is the sense of doubt. You know, someone who has lots of doubt, that's a problem that gets in the way of the practice. But I don't know where you got the idea that that either of those things in the Mahamangala Sutta means giving up faithlessness. Because then you ask, what did the Buddha mean faith? Does the Buddha mean faith in where does the Buddha mean where? Because the Buddha doesn't say there faith. He He says, Pubeja kata punyata attasama paniti. There's nothing about faith. But to that being said, faith in the Buddha, the Dhamma, and the Sangha is useful. It is a good thing. It's just not the ultimate thing. When you have faith in the Buddha, you're more likely to follow his example and listen to his teachings. When you have faith in the Dhamma, you're much more likely to put it into practice. When you have faith in the Sangha, you're much more likely to listen to the things they say. But it's inferior. It's not the goal. It can be a useful tool, especially in the beginning. But eventually it's replaced by faith in the practice and by faith in your own wisdom, your own understanding that you've gained from the practice. And eventually that's faith replaced by something that shouldn't really be called faith at all. It's replaced by knowledge, which leads to confidence, perfect certainty, which is quite different. It's the same quality, it's just much stronger and it's absolutely unshakable.
Can one remember cessation?
You have to find out.
Bhante, have you broken the chain of samsara? Is it typical for a monk to be reborn?
No comment.
Is there anything in Buddhism that resembles confession in Catholicism?
Monks have it. And for lay people? No, I mean, monks are more like rabbis in this sense. You know, people come to the monks. It's not a very good comparison, but in that sense, monks are... monks will... be therapists or be there to listen to people's problems and to give advice. But we don't have any set up structure for lay people to confess their offenses because there's no sense that that's necessary. One has to learn from one's offenses. You know, we're not, it's not about telling God or, yeah. But monks have this confessing of offenses, but it's more as a means of training. Because the fact that you have to confess it to someone makes you less likely to do it. And once you have confessed it, it makes it easier for people to help you make sure you don't commit it in the future. But it also helps to get your weight off your chest. So some people like to come and talk to monks like that. I know that's what confession's probably used for, is to get the weight off your chest, make you feel better. So it's not to say that it's not helpful. It's just that we do more of a therapist thing where we meet with people and talk with them, discuss their problems and help them resolve them.
Can you explain how notation technique works with citta, rupa, and nama? My practice is getting a bit clumsy about this.
I don't understand the question. Do you?
No.
Right. Sorry.
I'm finding it much easier to clearly focus on the mantra when walking compared to sitting. Is this the norm amongst meditators?
It will change. Sometimes it'll be easier in walking, sometimes it'll be easier in sitting. Sometimes neither one of them will be easy, sometimes they'll both be easy. It's just a state of being. It has to do with the differences in the quality, because walking is more likely to lead to energy or effort. Sitting is more likely to lead to concentration or focus. And so at different stages, they will be more useful or less useful. That's why we do them both, because they help to balance out the mind.
And also when you're walking, you don't, you know, pick up and note something different. You remain with the feet. But when you're sitting, you know, what you're noting will, you know, change depending on.
Well, sitting is more intense, but, you know, when you spend any time teaching people, this question comes up a lot, but it varies what they're saying. I find sitting meditation a lot easier. Why is that? I find walking meditation so easy. I can't do walking meditation. I can't do sitting meditation. The only conclusion you can draw is that it's impermanent. And that's usually what happens. They'll come the next day or a few days later and say, okay, now walking is easy and sitting is hard, or now sitting is easy and walking is hard. Eventually you just get good at both of them.
Have Hira and Otapa been important in the relationships with your teachers? I don't know what either of those are. Hopefully you do.
Yeah, I don't quite understand how they relate. I guess, are you asking either, do I have those, or do I have those towards my teacher, or do my teachers have those towards me? Shame and fear of blame. So aversion towards, not aversion, but disinclination towards unwholesomeness, and disinclination towards the result of unwholesomeness. I mean, you do have to have some kind of sense of respect for your teachers. I think this is probably what you're getting at, is the idea of respect, because we do talk about Hiri and Otapa in terms of our respect for our teachers. You know, I think it's very important, respect for teachers. If you take someone as your teacher, or even if you want someone to teach you something, you know, if you ask someone, hey, can you talk to me about this? If they're taking the time to give you knowledge, I mean, it's a precious gift. So that kind of thing deserves respect, and it's a shame that in the West we just don't get that sometimes. Our teachers get paid, right? And we've never been taught that somehow. In Asia, in Buddhist countries, they're often drilled into them. It's funny because the teachers there are still getting paid, but you know, the tradition of having teachers who didn't get paid is still there, which is the tradition that you respect your teachers because they're doing you a service. That's why I'd never want to teach for money, because then people would have a legitimate reason to disrespect me, to expect me to perform. But here, when people criticize me, I can say, yeah, you don't like it, go away.
Andy, can you just say what those are again? Hira is shame.
Hiri is disinclination towards evil deeds. Otapa is disinclination towards their results.
Okay.
I mean, that's technically what they really mean, are shame in regards to bad deeds that you have done or that you're intending to do. And otapa is fear of the consequences of bad deeds.
Okay, thank you.
But because neither fear or shame are wholesome, it has to mean something a little bit more technical, which is just a disinclination, I think.
Ante, what is the best way to deal with interference in the world during daily sati? I practice noting, but my concentration still breaks after a while.
Well, it's because you're not perfect. It just takes time. Time and patience. Like, you practice, and what, you think it should be perfect? That's why we call it practice, not perfect. Practice means you get better at it. So, you know that you still have yet to get better. You have better yet to get.
Not a question, but maybe an important comment. Ante, you keep getting out of focus in the video because you're not in the center of the frame. In other words, you're too low and you have autofocus on your camera.
No, but if I go down too low, then it focuses on the mic. So I don't know. I can't turn off the autofocus. I wish I could, but these crazy cameras that think they know better than us. If there was a manual focus option, I'd put turn it on. If I was using Windows, there probably would be a manual focus option, but darn things that are made for Windows.
This is the camera that teaches the three characteristics.
Yeah.
When I learned about the five aggregates, the mental factors were described as arising one by one through consciousness, landing on a sense organ. But for example, when I'm watching you speak, it seems at least eye consciousness, ear consciousness, and thought consciousness are simultaneously giving arising to all types of mental factors. There seems to be a lot of overlap rather than discreteness and separation. Why is it not described this way instead?
It is described that way, actually. What you learned was wrong. Mental factors do not arise one by one through consciousness, landing on a sense organ. Consciousness arises one by one, but the mental concomitants are in each consciousness, and each consciousness has a different array of mental concomitants, usually tens of them. But the actual makeup of each consciousness differs, depending on its function, depending on its nature, depending on its ethical quality. For that you have to study the Abhidhamma. But mental concomitants have the following characteristics. They arise with consciousness, they cease with consciousness, they take the same object as consciousness, and I think there's a fourth one. They have the same base as consciousness. Not that they arise one by one.
You mentioned that when you were younger, you taught meditation to fellow karate students. I'm curious to know how you first discovered meditation and who your first teacher was.
I can't remember which happened first, but I think two things happened. One, I was reading books from my parents. My mother had some hippie books, one by I think Deepak Chopra. But the big one was Shakti Gawain. Gawain, I can't remember exactly how you say it. But a funny thing, just that when I was at McMaster, I took part in a meditation session by a lay teacher there, and he was talking about this guy Shakti Gawain or Gawain, however you say it, called Creative Visualization, and it's apparently a big book in New Age Hindu circles. And so I was practicing that for a while. There was a lot of imagining rainbows of energy coming up your front and going down your back and coming out of the top of your head and out and up from your toes and in a cycle like this. And so I did a bunch of that on my own. Didn't really get anything out of it. And then the other thing was my karate teacher. He was the one who gave me the idea because he taught us meditation. With this orange. So he said, you lie down, everyone lay down and imagined an orange. He was a French, French-Canadian guy who I guess had been part of the hippie movement as well, along with my parents. And really nice guy. But he would have us lie down and imagine peeling an orange and taking the pieces of the orange and then tasting the orange. So more visualization. I can't remember which came first, but that sort of got me into meditation. But really the funny thing is when I finally, at 20 years old, decided to go to Thailand and find Taoism, which is what I was looking for, I had no interest in meditation nor any inclination or proficiency in it. So when I sat down and tried to meditate, I found I couldn't sit still for any period of time at all, not 10 seconds. And when I went to do this meditation course, it was sort of it was only because it was a big thing in the guidebook. The guidebook I was looking at kept saying that this is what people did for spirituality in Thailand. So I thought, well, I'll try it and see. Somehow I got around to meditating, but it wasn't in my mind and wasn't really what I was looking for. So I don't want to give the impression that I was a meditator since I was young, because it may have helped a little bit or given me something, but certainly wasn't always on my mind as a meditator. I certainly wasn't meditating through my teenage years. I mean, that would have been awesome. That's not true, though, entirely, because I guess I was. I was really having difficulty in high school and working really hard, getting high grades, but hating it. Kind of funny. And I would come back and lie down and do my own meditation. So I cultivated this. I wouldn't have even thought of it as meditation, but I felt like I was, I made it so that I felt like I was swaying in a hammock, and I could get my bed to sway back and forth like a hammock. Eventually I had an experience, some sort of mystical experience through that, but eventually I gave that up and stopped doing it. And by the time I went to Thailand, I don't think I was doing any meditation.
Do you read Kobo ebooks? The reason I ask is I would like to send you an ebook of your choice as a gift.
Well, thank you for your kind offer. I don't read Kobo ebooks. Don't even really know what they are. If you're reading ebooks, they should be EPUB. Why? Because that's an open source. It's an open standard. And we should encourage that kind of thing as Buddhists, because it involves the freedom of information and the public domain, I guess. You know, it's just, standards are very important. They bring peace. They're for the benefit of humanity, as opposed to individual companies that have proprietary standards. So if Kobo doesn't use EPUBs, I would recommend not using Kobo, whatever that is. So that's my philosophy, and I think it agrees with Buddhist philosophy in regards to the betterment of humanity as opposed to the betterment of a company. Proprietary standards are just useless in this world. They're a dinosaur that should go extinct.
You might have some convincing to do with a few large companies.
Dinosaurs. Just wait, they'll go extinct.
Venerable Yutadhammo, will you teach me an online course, please?
Well, there's a meeting. You can click on the Meet button. Meet at the top, and then you can sign up. If there's a spot available, you can join the
Mostly morning slots, which are 7 a.m. Eastern Time or 11 UTC time. It's mostly those, but there is a Saturday afternoon and a Sunday afternoon.
The person who was supposed to meet me this afternoon didn't show up, I don't think. And it's been left available.
Yeah, they had a message up here. They had gotten confused on the time. I see. Something.
Seems the time isn't working properly for some people, which is surprising, but...
Well, I don't know, but does it have anything to do with daylight savings time?
It might. I don't really understand how that could be, because it's using your browser. It's more reasonable to me that you've got your time set wrong, your time zone set wrong. I don't know. If you've got your location set wrong, I bet that would do it. Because then it'll miscalculate the difference between where you are and UTC.
I only remember last year when we switched the clocks back, there was a little confusion with, a year ago we had kind of three groups that were doing meditation, one in the morning, one in the afternoon, and one in the evening, Eastern time. There was a little confusion. So just to clarify, when those of us in countries that have daylight savings time change our clocks in another week or so on November 1st, will anything in this broadcast change? Or will it be at the same time?
It'll be at the same time. It'll be at the same time. It's a question of whether or not we can properly broadcast that, which is a good question. So I think there's not any system in place to make that elegant yet. But it's probably just going to be something on the back end to change the times of everything. So instead of being told that something's at this time UTC, there will be a +1 inserted somewhere. It'll just, or plus 60 probably, it'll be a plus 60 minutes. Everything will be 60 minutes later, right? Because we're falling back, so it's got to be 60 minutes later. Hopefully that'll work with everything, the appointments, the front page. The front page shouldn't change. That should still be correct, because your browser should be able to calculate. And
so apart from the technical aspects of, you know, as far as people showing up, if you're in a country that changes due to daylight savings time, we'll be meeting at the same time, you know, according to the new time. But if your country doesn't change,
it'll be the same time according to me. That's what you have to know. It'll be the same time Eastern. So you have to ask, what you have to Google, what time is it in New York? Or what time is it in Toronto? If you Google that, that's the time. And this is at 9 p.m. that time. That's when we started this broadcast. Figure out what time it is then. That's the only reasonable way. But also the website should be showing the new times. So.
Neo doesn't think the meet spots are working. I think you just have to click on them, right? You just have to click on one that says available.
Yep.
Why not?
That's what should work. Okay, you want to see what the new video looks like? Here's what it... Can you see that?
Yes. Oh, wow.
No, I think I have to click there and I'll present to everyone. So it should be a little whiter. Like this should be white. But it's pretty good.
Definitely.
You need brighter lights behind you, but I had some fairly bright lights. Anyway. So that's going up on YouTube now.
Just a little more information on Kobo. They're a Canadian company who are second to Amazon, and they use DRM e-pumps.
DRM, no. No DRM. If it has DRM, I don't want it. DRM is broken by design. I don't believe in it.
And Brenna is asking, is the meet feature exclusively for those who are meditating every day?
Yes, not every day, not meeting every day, meditating every day.
Yes, can you meet with you weekly only if you're meditating every day?
Yes, at least 1 hour, preferably two. But if you only do 1 hour in the beginning, that's fine. We work up to two, hopefully.
Quite up.
All right. And good night, everyone. Thank you all for tuning in. Thanks, Robin, for your help.
Thank you, Bhante.
See you all next time.
Good night.
Good night.